This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. Thanks for joining us. When Raymond DiPaolo was deciding what to study in college in the late 1960s, he chose psychiatry because he wanted to better understand people. He began as a student at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in 1968 and went on to become an MD in 1972 and then did his residencies there. He founded the Affective Disorder Clinic at Johns Hopkins in 1977. That was the term used for what are now referred to as mood disorders. And these days, he's co-director of the Johns Hopkins Mood Disorders Clinic. He's also a University Distinguished Service Professor and has been an active clinician, teacher, and researcher throughout his career. His research interests focus on clinical assessment, diagnosis, causes, and treatments for mood disorders. Dr. DiPaolo's research group led several early genetic studies of bipolar disorder and unipolar depression, and he has authored more than 140 peer-reviewed scientific articles. He was on the Florida Gulf Coast University campus last Thursday to give a talk for the university's Provost Seminar Series, so stopped by the studio for a conversation about his work and career and the changes he's seen over the past 58 years. Let's hear that now. Dr. Ray DiPaolo is co-director of the Mood Disorder Center at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Welcome back to the show, Dr. DiPaolo.
Thank you.
How's it been being in Southwest Florida and not in the snow so far?
Nice. Very nice.
So you founded the original Affective Disorders Clinic at Johns Hopkins in 1977. We were chatting before the show, and you said you started there as a student in 1968. So you've been there involved one way or another for 58 years. So you've seen a lot. I want to go back to the early days. When did you first become aware of the practice of psychiatry and it intrigued you in such a way that you wanted to pursue it academically?
Yeah, it's kind of a stepwise thing. I think when I was in high school, my family got involved in some things, including John Kennedy's primary election trial in West Virginia as a Democrat, young Democrat. And he was a young Democrat then, and everybody in West Virginia was a Democrat then too. And they decided that they probably, if they got 40% of the vote, that was going to be good, okay? Because back then, there was a religious issue. That is, he was Catholic, and people were concerned about that. So at any rate, thought maybe the Pope would be over here running the country. And so he got 60%, and it surprised them, and it persuaded me that I didn't understand people well enough.
Huh.
And that was kind of a nidus for me, that I don't understand people very well, and I want to do something in the sciences and in the helping profession somewhere. And so be a doctor was kind of a logical try. So I was curious or befuddled, didn't understand people very well, was very interested in what motivated people to do things that they did. And so I was thinking about – I knew nothing really about psychiatry in reality, but I was thinking that that might be a way of, you know, using my skills – scientifically and trying to help people.
So you started there as a student in 68 and you started there as a staffer, I guess, in 77?
Yeah. Had all those years of internship and residency in between.
So the Affective Disorders Clinic is what it was called until it changed to the Mood Disorders Clinic. Mm-hmm. I was digging into it earlier, and that pivot happened apparently in 1987 when the DSM-3 came out. Did I get that right?
Close.
So explain why that name change happened.
Well, I think it was because DSM-3 became the outline, at least, of the textbook, right, on psychiatry. And it was called mood disorders there. I think affective disorders, in a sense, is more descriptive of the set of conditions we're trying to treat, because it's affective. Those affective functions are those things distinguished from the cognitive functions in terms of what your brain does. We all know we have emotions and intellect, and the emotional side, if you will, was usually referred to as the affective functions. But it would include appetites and things like that, as well as emotions, you know, happy, sad, anxious, depressed. So it covered a bigger range, affective did. And I think we still don't understand these disorders. And so and certainly to see them as mood disorders in some ways would be to make it too narrow.
Is mood disorder most commonly the thing people would understand is like bipolar disorder or depression? Is that what most – is the
right.
most commonly understood example of mood disorder?
Yes, that's right. That's how that people would see it, right. And that's what we treat mostly are the people in a place that does a lot of specialization. we would say the people on specializing in depression and bipolar disorder being less frequent, but still common by comparison to many medical conditions. About 1% of the population has bipolar disorder, that is severe bipolar disorder, now called bipolar type 1.
Is there a type 2?
There is, for what it's worth, and it's still a slightly mysterious category we've created. And then we move the goalposts on that one as we're trying to figure out what it really is.
So
it's closer, probably very as easily related to depression as it is to bipolar disorder, because they have a lot of depression, but not much in the way of mania or hypomania.
Where does borderline personality disorder fit in? Is that a different category?
It is. It's a different realm in a sense. Personality is the giveaway there, is that people do have personalities, and personalities are as a construct, just like the word disease is a construct. And people have therefore understand they have people do have temperaments or traits, and those temperaments are in a particular constellation can sometimes be looked at as a borderline. That's a crazy way it got its name, by the way, because I treated patients who had that same what we would today call borderline before we had that word to call it borderline, and we knew them as extroverted but highly anxious and easily depressed and discouraged people. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, those traits, but today they represent a particular, probably the most commonly used term for a personality disorder would be borderline. But it's a different kettle of fish entirely in a way. Doesn't mean the people don't get diseases too, like depression and bipolar disorder, but it's considered a different kettle of fish. If you go back to the basics, if you will, like we're constructing this map of mental disorders. And you'd say, well, there are certain things that are about dispositions, okay, and other things that are about, disorders that are, in a sense, genetically driven on the one hand, but also triggered environmentally.
When did genetics come into the story in terms of understanding something like bipolar disorder? It seems like there was an understanding of hereditariness or whatever.
Right.
Going probably really far back because you could sort of see that. But when did genes mm-hmm. enter into it? Throughout the course of your career?
Yes. But it's a very good point just to kind of tack down those points that you mentioned, which is correct. When Emil Kraepelin, the German psychiatrist, coined the phrase manic depressive insanity, which later became bipolar disorder, and he talked about it being very familial, that it ran in families. He showed a pedigree of I think 10 children of whom, 7 of whom had it, right? That sort of thing. So that part was known, as you say, almost back to antiquity. But it's when genetics became a thing where we could literally put the DNA in our hands and start manipulating it. And so we could study it and we could sequence it and that sort of thing. And that was the mid-80s to 1990 in there, where the Genome Project at the National Institute of Mental Health National Institute of Health, started in about 1990, 1991. And that's about the time that it became, in that sense, genetic. And the point's right. In other words, we could look at the genetics in a more literal way at the molecular level.
Have you gotten to a point now where you can look at somebody's genome sequence and understand what's going on?
No. The point is, it looks like it's going to, and it looks like for bipolar disorder, which is probably quite many times probably simpler in a way than depression, which affects 10 to 20% of the population, then we know that must be hundreds of different things. In fact, I go back and look at, if you want an example, I go back and look at the disorders that you would have seen in the TV series Downton Abbey, where there was a character with dropsy, okay, the young woman who had dropsy. And dropsy, it turned out to be a swollen person with a lot of fluid swelling. And it turns out that the major causes for that were heart failure, but also liver failure, and also to a certain extent, kidney failure. Okay? And back then, they didn't know how to separate those things up. And when they eventually learned to separate them up, then they started really making progress. And so we have good treatments for heart failure. We don't have such good treatments for liver failure. And we have at least ways to accommodate renal failure with dialysis and with transplanting kidneys.
So when it comes to mood disorders today in 2026, do we have good treatments?
Well, we have treatments that don't work well enough and who take much too long. But with effort and understanding of what it takes to find out if something doesn't work. That's how you got to take it long enough at a reasonable enough dose to find out if it's going to work. And in the meantime, we need to do whatever we can to help the person get better in the short term. But these are long-term illnesses, and so we're looking for something that'll make a difference in the long run. And that takes a while. So that I have a patient who has very severe depressions. You know, I have ways to get them better initially, but then the trick is to how to keep them well. That's a bigger difficulty. And the issue there is not perfection so much as it is, well, it's better to go 10 years without an episode of depression than it is to go 6 months or a year without depression, okay? The second part being, you know, takes work of a patient and a clinician and probably the good work of many therapists along the way.
I don't know if you can answer this question, but can you isolate something that is part of the standard of care today that would have seemed like far-fetched 50 years ago?
50 years ago is not that far back for me.
or longer. Something that has emerged right over the course of your career that would have been aspirational, if not even like hadn't been thought of yet.
Yeah. Well, to go back, before 1970, okay, and I started medical school in 68. Before 1970, many people thought that there were no actual quote unquote diseases, sorry about the phrase, as if anything's actual there, but it's the idea of a disease is something that afflicts the patient, right, and that is not the patient themselves, even though it might come internally. But that notion that psychiatric disorders included those things like pneumonia or diabetes was still not accepted until around 1970. Okay, partly that was because it was the U.S. The U.S. was the haven for psychoanalysis then, okay? And it was thought that since there were no treatments that came with the notion that it was hereditary, and because it was mysterious, and it still is mysterious, we hadn't discovered empirically treatments that made a big difference. And it was about then that it was clear that certain drugs that are colloquially called antipsychotics, I prefer a different term, but that's okay, that they were helping patients with schizophrenia to a certain extent. It didn't make them, didn't take away their disability. It took away some of their more florid symptoms. Hmm. And we were just learning that antidepressants really could work. Okay, so, and lithium was actually not approved until 70 by the FDA in this country again. So at least in this country, 1970, but probably closer to 1970, it was starting to be understood that there were quote unquote diseases in psychiatry, not just troubled people. But now we know that sometimes the trouble is that they have something that they didn't create and that somehow came out of them that has a genetic contribution to it. And we can now say it is a genetic contribution. But I would say in bipolar disorder, which I've studied the most, so far we haven't found an example where we could relate that directly to the DNA base pair sequences, okay? But their genetics and hereditary is more nuanced than that. And we're now looking at what do those genes make in what body parts, okay, in what parts of the brain. And there's variation there too. In other words, you can have the same DNA sequence and you can make more than one machine that creates proteins, okay? You can make it a three-bedroom house or a two-bedroom house out of that. And that's where we are now is people are looking at the sequences, but those sequences of transcripts occur in tissues. And so it's really complicated now.
Yeah. I mean, but do you feel like on the road that we're on, the road that you're on with the rise of technology, robust machine learning, being able to look at a whole lot of data, I mean, are we going to get to a point where there is more clarity?
Yes, we are, eventually. But it's very much like I got to see the war on cancer, which started in 1971 when I was a junior in medical school and half of my class went into cancer. And half of them went to the National Institute National Cancer Institute, just 30 miles down the road from Johns Hopkins. And so I would still see them every year for softball games and picnics in the spring, And so we would talk about what they were doing, and I would say to them that they didn't know what they were doing. I can remember a comment I made that was probably really reprehensible. I said that you guys are throwing the periodic table at cancer. And they said, look, Ray, we understand that we don't know now enough to translate what we're learning in the experimental lab to our patients. But we're making progress. We're getting better experiments, and eventually we know we'll make some progress. And, of course, they have made progress. Haven't cured all of cancer, but they've changed the nature of what it is to have cancer and the nature of being a physician who has to treat somebody with cancer. So that's where we want to get. That's a reasonable next platform that we want to be on, is where they are now, but it'll take a while. And our problem is more complicated than theirs.
What is your take on – I know part of your talk today is going to be about AI. Mm-hmm. What is your take on you know, people out in the world that are going to these language models to have conversations about things that they're experiencing that may fall into the psychiatric disorder category?
Yeah. I think it's I know it happened, and I know people feel reassured by these programmed response systems. Okay, but it's not good or safe or reasonable way to get therapy for a mental disorder because the response that seems empathic, in fact, is coming from a machine that doesn't know you, doesn't know anyone, just knows its rules. And so it lacks, it lacks authenticity. There's no person behind that machine who has experience enough to say, well, today's not a good day for us to do this sort of therapy. Today's a day when we're just going to try to cope with what you've been through since your mother passed away last week, right? That sort of thing. And also not one to say, well, this idea, this question you asked me about what would it take to have a lethal dose of X or Y medicine or chemical, no, that suggesting that to me makes me sound like you're really worried about thinking about, you know, your own life and the future of it. And that's not the place for us to take up that topic. It's not a chemistry question.
It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that one thing that has changed a lot over the decades is people used to hide things like mental situations. And, you know, now, like, we do a show every year with a group for high school students called Normal is Overrated that gets young people to talk about their mental states and their mental disorders in a way that's open so they don't have to feel like they're hiding it. How does that fit into the puzzle of the work that you do?
Well, it's an important part and it's a good part, okay? But that's right. That's why it's maybe subject at times to people finding home remedies that don't work. And we need to warn them about things that have dangers. But there's some things that we do outside the therapeutic setting that are helpful. I mean,
like not hiding it, you know,
right.
like being able to talk to your loved ones about something that you're dealing with and not having to, because hiding it itself would be a psychological burden.
Absolutely right. And we think that helps a little bit, but if you're severely affected, and that's the bias that I see because those are the patients I see.
I see.
It doesn't change the nature of the disorder. And in fact, even the most intelligent person who knows the most will lose their insight if they get sick enough. A severe depression will persuade them that, no, this is not a disease that's affecting them. This is about them, that they are really defective from the get-go, right? Even when they know when they're well that that's not the case. And of course, if they get manic, they think that they know everything and that they're invulnerable. And they don't know that jumping out the window, as one of my patients did, was not a good thing for their health. So those can be just as intelligent and just as insightful a person when they're well. So severe forms of the illness, that doesn't help at that moment. In general, for people that have milder forms of the disorder,
like societally, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very good thing. And especially because there might be somebody who knows somebody they can go to help them, right? And if the person's of the right set, they say, yeah, look, let's do that. But an awful lot of people, I would say, of the people that come to see me for depression, probably a good half of them don't think they really need to do it, or they think that they're not ill enough to deserve it or merit it, okay? And I have to tell them, no, we're going to have plenty of hard work for us to do to help you. But yes, you do deserve it. Look at what you're not doing now that you were doing before. Wouldn't it be better if you were able to go back and, you know, apply your talents? And, of course, many of these people that we treat are physicians, and we'd like them to get back to taking care of patients.
Interesting.
Yeah.
When you are working with somebody who is being severely affected, is working with their family part of the story too?
It is, assuming they have a family. Now,
yeah,
in East
yeah.
Baltimore, there are plenty of people, unfortunately, that don't really have a functioning family, okay? But, yes, the family is very important because they're the nearest people who care about the person by and large. And we need to educate them too. And they are the people that will be, at times when the person has lost insight, they're the people that can crowd around and have what some people would call an intervention to save John or Mary and to say, look, we can't lose you, and you're falling off a cliff right now.
So if you had to look at the horizon, what would you say is the most promising next step that might occur in terms of clinical understanding or treatment?
Well, it depends a little bit on – well, but it's very much the same, although it's interesting. I've been to other countries, and as much as I admire their national health services so that everybody has access to care, still these same stigmas apply in a general way, that actually even in England, where they have a great national health service – not everybody in this country would think of it as great, but over there they do that it's still true that psychiatrists are hived off and they're usually at a separate facility, and they actually get paid out of a different pot of money, and which was interesting for me to learn, to say that it's still shadows. But ours is worse in a way, in that we don't have a system where that's necessarily understood. And so it's like, well, I'm going to send you to see this person, but that isn't necessarily somebody the person works with all the time. And what we do see is that about 80% of our what we would call psychiatric care could be provided in a family medicine or primary care setting if we had enough expertise there to give people, the doctors and the nurses and the social workers who work there, the support they need to understand which direction to be moving.
And we – correct me if I'm wrong – we need, especially here in Florida, a whole lot more people who are trained to do that kind of stuff, because I think that we are near the bottom of the list when it comes to like therapists per – person in need.
Right. But all of those therapists, us doctors and the nurses and everybody and social workers need to be working together in a more team-like fashion. Right now there's private practitioners are individuals, and unfortunately sometimes we see someone doing the therapy not in coordination at all with the person trying to treat the illness medically, perhaps. That's one of the reasons why the psychiatrists who do it all together, that can help at least integrate the therapy. But it's especially good if they work in a setting where they have psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and they work as a team. That's the ideal.
Do you think we can get there? I mean, do you think that because we seriously – I mean, we seem to have a serious problem but with mental health, and we have to do something.
Right. No, we can. It's not that we can't. There's no doubt we can. But you know, what is it going to take to get there, right? And I've seen things happen in my lifetime that are good. Like you said, the public information out there about these disorders is enormously better. And that does help. At least it creates the question. You can ask me that question then. When are we going to get the resources put together in the right way that'll get us the care we need? But if you don't know that other stuff, that these are disorders that normal, quote-unquote normal people can get and do get, and that it impairs their functioning and it should be reparable, then you can't ask the question even. And asking the question means you've defined the problem.
Last question. 58 years you've been in or around Johns Hopkins. Are you there still? I mean, are you years and years ahead?
I hope so. I'm having a lot of fun doing it. I still love taking care of patients. I love teaching and mentoring. And I love working with patients, not only the patients, but their families.
And there's a new DSM coming out, I heard on NPR yesterday.
Well, that's right, DSM-6.
They're now going to an evolutionary model, if you will, where it won't just be a new tome. It'll be – I forget what the term they used for it.
I'm not sure which term you've heard, but
it's going to be a living
– right.
A living – not document. It's a little long for a document, right. But I think that was the word I heard.
Well, that's fair enough. And I understand what you mean by living, meaning it's going to change as the changes occur.
Yeah. It won't just be like every 10 years they drop a new 800-page book.
But I was on DSM-5, and I was on the mood disorders section on DSM-5. And you got to understand what – we all need to know our limits, right? And what are the limits of a DSM? Well, the DSM is a set of categories with a set of criteria, okay? It is not a – it does not have within it the understanding of a life, okay? Nor does it have a proper examination of a patient's history. So one of the problems there is it's put everything down to an algorithm, okay? And that is not the same thing as understanding the disorder that the person's suffering from, nor is it understanding the person who has the disorder, which are very – both are very important. So that's what we worry about in medicine today is that we have diseases, but there isn't a person in the center of a disease, okay? The disease model, which is a structural model, that the ultimate human part of that is called the syndrome. That is the set of symptoms. And but what we really need, if we believe that the disease is the right model for what they have, is to find the bodily abnormality that generates it and then go about the research that would tell us what creates that abnormality.
Hmm.
Now, that's the disease model, okay? But the point is people's mental life can go wrong for other reasons. And whether it's their temperament, you mentioned borderline, okay, interacting with them in other ways, or it's a behavior like drinking alcohol and becoming dependent on it, okay, that's the strategy of treatment would be quite different for them. Or an eating disorder, for example. That's another behavior that people do. Or if it really is a response to things that they've experienced, then we call PTSD or bereavement. Those are understood in terms of things that the person's encountered. So all of those things, and all those things can come together in the single person as well, of course. And how you put that all together is not the same as the algorithms that give us the categories.
You said you went to college for psychiatry because you wanted to understand humans better. Do you feel like you've learned something?
Very good. What I've learned is that that's a journey, not a destination.
Yeah.
I understand them one at a time.
Hmm.
With some, you know, get better as we go along.
Well, that's all the time we have. Dr. Ray DiPaolo is co-director of the Mood Disorder Center at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Thank you so much for talking. It's nice talking to you again.
Thanks. Nice to see you again.
Dr. DiPaolo was on the FGCU campus last week to give a talk as part of the university's Provost Seminar Series. He also talked with the Naples Discussion Group while he was in Southwest Florida. If you missed any of the show, you can always hear all of our episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or wherever you find podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly with assistance from Jared Gonzalez. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Conivery. This is WGCU-FM. Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.